My guest has joined me, Alex Summers. Hi, Alex.
Hi there, Liz. How are we doing?
Good. I'm good. It's nice to see you. So you are a glasshouse supervisor at the Botanic Gardens in Cambridge.
Yep, I am. Yep. And we're currently running our Orchids 2017 festival at the moment. So if everybody pops into the gardens at the moment, they should expect to see orchids, snowdrops and everything else that's happening at this time of year.
Yeah, because Lee Chambers was saying she'd seen the snowdrops at the weekend. They're looking beautiful.
They look incredible. I have never seen them look so good at the gardens. I think both weather and also the gardens put a lot of effort into putting a lot more snowdrops in and around, but they absolutely blanket some of the beds.
Oh, wow, that does sound gorgeous. Well, I went on Wednesday night for the twilight experience, so I saw some orchids. Now, orchids are notoriously hard to grow, surely.
They are and they aren't. If you think that the orchid is the most common houseplant these days, thanks to the hard work of the Dutch, but yeah, the moth orchid that we all grow at home has made orchids a very easy thing for many of us to include. However, it is a family with 25,000 species, so there is a lot of very difficult orchids. And I think due to their rarity and the difficulty when people first started growing them in the late 1800s, that's what really made them into these precious items that people really still held up on a pedestal as some of those really difficult, really odd things that they come to see, especially at gardens or within other such institutions.
They have become massively popular, haven't they?
Yeah, massively so. I think as a houseplant, they're really quite carefree and they have a very long flowering time. And they are exotic. Let's face it, you can't get away from the fact that they are. I mean, the great thing about our orchid festival is that we're able to use a lot of our own orchids. And that means that we're able to show people a lot of that diversity within the orchid kingdom. And that's what we really set forward to do, is not just focus on Phalaenopsis or Dendrobium, which people will be used to from the supermarket, but actually showing them the vast array of orchid morphology and actually maybe telling a little bit about that and what makes an orchid. This year, obviously, we're focusing on India. But in previous years, we've really focused on trying to explain what makes an orchid an orchid.
So what does make an orchid an orchid?
A number of things, but it all comes down to flower, and it comes down to flower morphology. So they'll have a shared characters within the flower and within the greater plant, which will hold them together as a family.
OK, so, I mean, when I was there, obviously, it was quite dark. I mean, it was lit up beautifully, but it felt very kind of jungly. I mean, it was... obviously, the temperature is quite warm in there, which is lovely.
Yeah, so we run it at... I mean, the tropical houses run at 18 year-round, so that's the minimum they ever reach. But if people want to escape the cold, and let's face it, it's not cold at all, actually, at the moment. It's really mild. But on those cold days or those wet days, it's always at 18 or above in the tropical houses and about 12 and above in the rest of the houses, because the plant material we grow can't actually go below those temperatures. So if you imagine plants from the tropics, they never come into contact with the frost, and therefore if they do, that's instant death.
So Alex, you're in charge of obviously keeping these plants alive. Is that pressure? Is that stressful? Getting them to flower at the same time?
Depending on the plant material. Funnily enough, the orchids aren't the issue. The orchids generally do as they should do. And when you follow a couple of basic rules with lots of orchids, particularly the ones that come from the tropics, they are quite easy to work with. Other things like our Victoria, for example, the big water lily that people will be used to seeing post the Orchid Festival, that can be a little bit more difficult and a little bit more stressful. But for the majority of stuff, once we crack it, once we work out what's required, we can usually repeat that year in, year out.
So your orchids, how long are they going to be there for now?
So we've run from the 12th of February to the 12th of March. And throughout that period, people can expect to see orchids throughout the houses, and they can expect to see all the lovely interpretation that goes with that, explaining about India's natural heritage. But people should expect to see orchids throughout the range year round. So if you turn up, I pretty much guarantee that you should see an orchid in flower every day of the year. That's the fact that we've got nice diverse back collections, and the fact that orchids in themselves are a big diverse family which do lots of different things. You know, they flower throughout the year.
So tell me about the India connection. So what was the specific, you know, why India?
So we're celebrating 70 years of Indian independence, and this is being done across the University of Cambridge Museum. So there is a big event at the Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology coming post us, also entitled Another India. And it really is to try and theme something together across the museums and do something where we pull out our collections on a specific idea. India felt like a great one this year, and it has. It's been a great opportunity for us to, for example, discuss India's natural heritage, because I think a lot of people think of India as this one big, hot, steamy country, and yet it's got a multitude of biomes, everything from the Himalaya and the Alpine region to the 17th largest desert just on the border of Pakistan there, right down to those tropical steamy forests of Kerala and Goa down in southern India. So I think that's where our big aim was just to really introduce South Asia and the subcontinent.
So, yeah, I mean, it was quite interesting because obviously you've got some quite interesting things about India. As you walked around, there was obviously the prayer flags. And you're kind of learning a bit about India as you go, which is really interesting.
Yeah, we didn't want to be too shy of introducing culture. I think what we wanted to do was actually talk about India today, talk about the peoples of India today. Obviously, and its natural heritage. Whereas I think if you move on from our event to the Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology, you'll be able to get a lot more of that, and they're getting out a lot of their cool artefacts. But I think that we wanted to just add some of that colour and culture in with the orchids, with the interpretation, and we've also highlighted a lot of our Indian plants within and throughout the range, just so that anyone coming in can get that feel and can understand a bit more about India.
Mm. It gives it a nice story, because I love the floating. There was like a floating orchid display with some
that's
candles
really cool.
Or lights or something.
Well, every year we sort of rely on 1,001 favours, 1,001 helping hands from here, there and everywhere. For example, one of our large images was painted this year by our Garden staff. That structure was built by the Trinity's carpenter, and then we obviously set it, or my assistant, Alan, did a great job of planting that with all the orchids that were done there. And then we've got two large paintings that our marketing assistant's daughter did all the painting work for us. She's in GCSE art now. And I think that's the big thing we're really big on with our festival, is not only to have the solid education backdrop to it, but also to make it something where we have as many people involved in producing it as possible.
Yeah, I mean, we're so lucky to have the Botanic Gardens, I think, on our doorstep. There's always something going on. But first, I want to talk to you about Vietnam.
Oh, Vietnam, yes.
So you went just before Christmas, is that right?
Yes, I was in Vietnam just the end of October, beginning of November.
And what specifically were you doing out there?
So we were collecting plant material, mainly seed material, and that is for the gardens collections. It was done in collaboration with Kew, with Royal Botanic Gardens Edinburgh, and with Glasgow Botanic Gardens. And that material the seed material will then go into our greater. So we made about 500 collections. That seed material will be spread across the gardens because we were collecting across an altitude. So we were collecting at lower subtropical zones, and then we were collecting up Vietnam, well, Indochina's largest mountains. So that's just up there in northwest Vietnam, which means that the tree material, particularly that we got above about 2,700 metres, that will be perfectly hardy and can be used in the wider garden collection. So that material will not only be used for the aesthetic of the garden, it could go into being used for research, for education purposes. And with garden collections, you've got to keep putting stuff in to ensure that they are usable for the many groups that come into the gardens to pull up the collections.
I see, it's quite interesting. So you get to travel and go off and do this at random places, or do you pick specific?
The choice of places comes down to a lot of things. It might come down to who we're collaborating with at the time, but increasingly it also comes down to where we want the collection to go. So the gardens has definite ideas, or definitely is formulating very definite ideas about where it wants things to go, and that will guide where collecting trips go out to.
And how long were you out there for?
There I was 3 weeks. So it was 3 weeks in the field. It was incredible. I mean, an amazing, amazing country. Not just the plant material, the culture. And it was a phenomenal opportunity. Yeah, really. And hopefully in the next couple of years, people should expect to see a lot of more Vietnamese material around the gardens.
So I read on your blog, because you did a blog when you were out there, that you found a previously unrecorded rhododendron, is that right?
We found, so it's very difficult at this point to say whether we found anything new, because a lot of the stuff we were collecting in the season when everything was in seed. So if you imagine going around our countryside in autumn, it's a lot more difficult to identify stuff when it doesn't have flowers on it. So what we can say is we think we found species that are new to science, like the rhododendron, but until we grow that up from seed and flower it, we won't be able to confirm that.
Yeah.
And that's part of doing it. We were working with our Vietnamese collaborators, and we will work together then when things are flowered to help update Vietnam's flora. That's really important, because you can't conserve anything or look after anything until you kind of know what's there. So that's part of the process.
But did you find that specifically? Were you very excited? Did you run off and...
Rhododendrons, I wouldn't say, are my number one thing. And if anybody is a gardener around Cambridge, they'll appreciate the rhododendrons in themselves. don't really grow around here because of our alkaline soils. However, there were many other things, I think, when it comes down to it. Some of the big sort of horse chestnuts we saw out there that were really, really exciting. But one of the guys we were with was really into rhododendrons from Edinburgh, and he was over the moon. I think, you know, he was sort of backwards and forwards with the interest on that one.
So what did you find that you specifically were most excited about?
I think for me, a lot of the smaller herbaceous material, because a lot of the things that are related to African violets that you might buy down in the garden centre, because those are things I'm actively going to grow. Ferns and some of the lower plant species, so things related to the ferns, they'll be coming into our houses. They've got real research potential, but for me, I find them very interesting as well. So they're things that I may have read about, but it was actually the opportunity to see them. And also the tree material. I mean, seeing the forests out there, they are spectacular. So the trees make those forests, and they're really cool, really cool.
I mean, so how do you become a horticulturalist? How does that happen?
So within our industry, I mean, you can do a horticultural qualification at most agricultural colleges around. And then from that, it's directing your sort of way. So I'm a botanical horticulturalist, and we have a traineeship at the garden, for example. I did the traineeship at the garden. I then also trained at Kew. And there are a number of institutions around the country that have that higher end horticultural training. But, you know, we have many gardeners who work as horticulturalists for private gardens, for general gardens around and about. So I think it's one of those industries which has a real diverse array of opportunities depending on what somebody wants to get out of it.
Mm. So do you know where you'll be going next, or what you'll be doing next? Have you got any plans?
That'd be great, yeah. I have no idea, because again, with all of this, it depends on where we're pushing with collection policy. So I think after Vietnam, the main aim is to get the material grown on, to really work with that. But I think in the future, hopefully somewhere tropical. That's am I interested? I love the tropics, and I would always push for that. But you never quite know.
So when you're growing something, is it very... it's obviously time-consuming. It's obviously a little bit unpredictable. I mean, I know there's science to it, but is it a bit luck? Or
yes, a lot of luck. No, I think a lot of it is driven by experience. Patience, where, you know, I mean, material that I started, so I started the gardens nearly about 4 and a bit years ago now, and some of the plant material I just started then is only coming to fruition now. Some of the material I may start then won't come, for example, some of the magnolias I collected in Vietnam may not flower for 15 to 20 years. So a lot of it's patience, but that's why I kind of enjoy it, because it's not instant. There's nothing instant about it, and there's a lot of problem solving. So with a lot of the more unusual material we grow, there is no book that tells you how to do it, and a lot of it comes down from my own personal experience or the experience of my colleagues, who are also very skilled, and so you just kind of work it out, and most of the time we get it right. But it's living. It's like my mum always says this to me when I'm complaining about these sort of things. She said, but it's a living thing at the end of the day, and if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. You can't take it to heart, if you know what I mean.
15 to 20 years, this is not the job for me. I mean, that's like having children, really, isn't it?
I think looking after the things is like having children. We have somebody in the gardens every day of the year to water the plant material. So, yeah, there is no respite from it. There is no point at which you can take back. For example, the glass collections, you know, they're watered every day. There is no opportunity at which you can say, I'm not going to look at them today, I'm not going to do this, that, or the other. And they're the sort of material that can have the habit of going down, declining, or dying on you at the drop of a hat. So I suppose it's easier than children, because if that happens with a child, you've got a lot bigger problem. With plants, at least, you know, I can either cut a bit off and try and root it, and if it does die, it dies, you know. That's the end of it. And we might be able to source more seed.
So how did you bring it back from Vietnam? Is it in a bag? Is it just in a...
It all comes back as clean seed. So we have to go through certain policies and protocols to make sure that it's all done legally. It will have all the permits that sit behind it. And the material itself will come through customs, because obviously we don't want to bring anything into the UK that we don't already have, and we don't want to compromise the plant and ecosystems that we already have in the UK.
I imagine them just wrapped up, like you wrap each individually.
Yeah, absolutely. We usually use paper envelopes.
Oh, right.
That's it. I know, there's nothing more glamorous than the North Face hold-all bag and a paper envelopes.
Okay. So tell us what else is happening, what we can look forward to at the Botanic Gardens over spring and summer. What events?
So if we go with the Orchid Festival specifically, or Orchids 2017, we've got lunchtime guided tours on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. We've got a Himalayan Plant Hunters event on Wednesday, the 8th of March, and that can be booked online. We've also got a How to Grow Orchids event from 6 to 8pm next week. And we have a free talk coming up this Saturday, 25th. Always have to think with dates. That's Cunning Killer Orchids, Sex, Science Fiction and Darwin by Jim Endersby. And that'll be at the Sainsbury's Lab. And pre-booking can be done from by phoning the gardens.
Okay, and give us the website address again if you could.
The website address is www.botanic.cam.ac.uk.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for coming in to talk to us, Alex. That has been really interesting.
Thank you. No, thanks for having us on the show.
Oh, it's brilliant. And I do love the Botanic Gardens, so I think it's well worth a visit any time of year and just get involved with what's happening there. Thank you very much.
Also just to push the winter garden as well. It's looking super at this time of year.
Oh. In fact, we're going to put some photos up, actually, on the website. Great. We're going to put some photos up so everyone can see. But, Alex, for now, thank you very much. And hopefully I'll speak to you again.